Hello, everyone, and welcome to Amanpour. Here's what's coming up.
I'm building Mac Greener. I'm building Mac Fairer.
Fairer, greener, more prosperous. That pledge from the leaders of the world's richest countries as they gather for the G7 summit. But how do they meet those aims? I'll ask the U.S. administration's special assistant to the president, Amanda Sloat. Plus,
the United States will respond in a robust and meaningful way when the Russian government engages in harmful activities.
Despite warnings from Biden, Putin tightens his iron fist. As organizations linked to Alexei Navalny are outlawed, I'll look at what this all means for the opposition movement. Then,
this is about routine and perfectly legal tax avoidance strategies.
How America's super rich avoid income tax. Journalist Jesse Eisinger, who broke the story, joins Hari Srinivasan. And finally, the great return to the office. Or is it? We discuss if and how remote working will be part of a post-pandemic world.
Welcome to the program, everyone. I'm Bianca Goladriga in New York, sitting in for Christian Amanpour. Christian is on medical leave and will return very soon. Economic and political heft on England's southwest coast. The G7 summit is finally underway in the picturesque Sandy Carbis Bay. And it's fair to say these leaders have a lot to discuss. The group represents about half of the world's GDP. High on the agenda, they say, building a fairer world. Well, never has that been more important as they look to end this pandemic, a pandemic that still rages in many of the world's poorest countries. The U.S., U.K., France, Germany, Italy, Canada, and Japan are collectively pledging 1 billion doses of vaccines to those countries that so desperately need them. Also on the docket, climate change, reigning in China, and preparing for future pandemics. Central to all of this is the United States and President Joe Biden, who will be heading to Geneva for a one-on-one with Russian President Vladimir Putin next week. I'm joined now by Amanda Sloat, special assistant to the president. She is traveling with the president all week. Amanda, welcome to the program. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
So welcome news, I would imagine, for those other world leaders, for the president to send messages like America is back and they share their mission to rebuild democracy, especially in the face of rising autocracy in the world. But as you know, actions speak louder than words. And when you look at some of the actions we have yet to see from this administration, including the lifting of the steel and aluminum sanctions put in place by President Trump, and missing still are key ambassadors to the EU, to NATO, to many European countries. Why is that?
Well, first of all, thank you for having me here. It's great to be in Carbis Bay, and we're really excited to have the first G7 meeting in over 2 years. It's a great opportunity for the president to meet with his fellow leaders in person and really to start rallying the world's democracies from a position of strength. I think to your question, we are now 4 or 5 months into the administration. The president has been very focused on commitments at home in terms of addressing the pandemic, in terms of addressing a lot of the economic recovery, and that's put us in a position of strength to be able to come here to work with our partners to address a lot of these global challenges. On the trade issues you cited, we started a very robust conversation over the last couple of months with our EU partners, and the administration has been working very hard to try and begin filling key slots within the administration.
As you mentioned, one priority and with a top priority is tackling coronavirus and sending vaccines to those countries that so desperately need them. The G7 is committed to sending 1 billion doses, half of that commitment coming from the United States alone. But I was stunned when I looked at these figures. I mean, in Cornwall alone, more people have been vaccinated than in the 22 poorest African countries combined. Is there a sense that the U.S. and other G7 countries are late to this in sending these vaccines, where we've seen Russia and particularly China send them much sooner?
I will certainly, the one thing that we have realized during this pandemic is that pandemics don't represent borders. And we in the United States are not going to be fully safe from the pandemic until we are able to vaccinate everybody around the world. The president campaigned on a desire to ramp up the vaccination effort in the United States. We are now in a significantly stronger position than we were when he took office in January. And it really is because of those domestic investments that the president made that we're now in a position to be able to share the 500 million vaccines that the president announced yesterday, and also to rally partners here at the G7 and, frankly, other international partners to stand up and do more as well. The president's announcement and our vaccine is going to be targeting 92 of those countries, and it's something that we feel well-positioned to do and welcome additional contributions from other countries as well.
We should say, though, more than 600 million doses have been distributed by China around the world, particularly to Latin America as well in that time. I'm curious, is there a sense or of agreed commitment to continue investigating the origins of COVID, in particular, whether or not it did in fact come from a lab leak as opposed to naturally from an animal to human?
This is something I think that the administration is continuing to look at in partnership with our other allies, continued conversations with the World Health Organization to understand the origins of the pandemic. And at the same time, we need to be continuing to work with our international partners to ensure that we have the global health security mechanisms in place to ensure that we have the resilience to be able to deal with future pandemics.
It's interesting. If you look back to President Trump's first visit to the G7 meeting, that is when Angela Merkel, the German chancellor, said famously that we are on our own in terms of Europe and having to lead their own fate going forward following the America First policy from President Trump. Obviously, President Biden delivering a different message, but many years have gone by now. And while he is focused on uniting democracies versus rising authoritarian leaders, excuse me, in particular China, other European countries don't necessarily see it that way, Germany and others. What is your take on that, and what needs to be done to help persuade them if that is in fact the case?
I think we are going to see a strong message of unity coming out of the G7 this weekend. After this, the president heads to Brussels, where he's going to be meeting with our NATO allies. It'll be the first time that there's a full summit since 2018. We're expecting a strong communique to be coming out of that. The president will then be meeting with the EU leadership. And you mentioned Chancellor Merkel. We announced earlier today that the president has invited her to come to Washington in July. So really, now that we are able to get out a little bit during the pandemic to engage with leaders. The president is very keen to be interacting with them in person and really to be rallying the world's democracies to try and start addressing some of these common challenges that we face. There certainly is a recognition that when you look at everything from China to climate to COVID, we are stronger and more effective when we are working in close partnership with our allies and with our multilateral partners. And that certainly is a message that the president is carrying into Carbis Bay and will be taking with him to Brussels next week as well.
And I would imagine taking with him to his meeting with Vladimir Putin as well next week in Geneva. One of the issues, many, that's going to be on their plate is what to do with neighboring Belarus, in particular after the downing of that airliner to take a dissident journalist off the plane. Lukashenko's authoritarianism has only risen over the past few years in his aggressive manner of treating those who are opposed to his government and his regime. I spoke with opposition leader Svetlana Tikhanovskaya earlier last week and asked her thoughts on what President Biden should say to Vladimir Putin on this issue in particular. Listen to what she said.
I think that Mr. Biden has to pass four clear messages to the Kremlin that situation in Belarus is not about geopolitics. It's our fight against regime inside the country. The second message is that to get out of this political and humanitarian crisis, we have to hold new free and fair elections this year. And the third message is that Russia has to stop support regime Lukashenko, because supporting regime, Kremlin is supporting violence and tortures in Belarus.
So is President Biden in agreement there with Svetlana Tikhanovskaya, and is he prepared to deliver these messages?
So I think President Biden is going to be engaging with President Putin on a wide range of issues. Some of them are going to be in areas where we want to try and find agreement in terms of strategic stability talks. Another one is going to be where there's areas of disagreement. On the specific issue of Belarus, President Biden has released a statement himself on this, expressing his horror at the situation that happened with the plane, his intention to deliver a very strong response. Some of those steps have already come out in terms of measures that the State Department, that the Federal Aviation Administration and others have issued. And we are continuing to remain in close consultation with the EU and our other allies on sanctions in response to this. So we certainly continue to remain very disturbed by this situation with the plane. We're continuing to support what the opposition is calling for free and fair elections under OSCE auspices. And the president has made very clear that there are going to be consequences.
Amanda, I'm asking, in terms of what the president can actually say to Vladimir Putin that will have an impact, there's no doubt that he will say the right things. But in terms of how Vladimir Putin will walk away from this, you just look at what's transpired since this meeting was announced. We've had two massive cyber attacks originating from Russia. Just this week, a Russian court has deemed any opposition figures extremists, in particular Alexei Navalny's, and it made them illegal. And the provocations keep happening from Russia. And it doesn't seem that sanctions or anything else, even isolation from memberships like the G7 or G8 as it was, are deterring him. Are you concerned at all that a meeting like this will only embolden Vladimir Putin?
We certainly don't see this meeting as a reward. President Biden, President Putin know each other. They go back many years, including engagements when the president was vice president. And we think it's important to have a conversation. In the president's conversation with him previously, he made clear that he was prepared to engage and cooperate in areas such as strategic stability where there was a shared interest. He is very interested in putting predictability back into the relationship. And at the same time, as we have seen with a number of the responses that the administration has taken over the last couple of months, there is a very different approach from what we saw in the last administration. And the president has made clear that he is not going to accept some of these actions and behaviors that we have seen from Russia over the last number of months and years. And that certainly is going to be on the agenda when the presidents meet.
I guess the question is whether Vladimir Putin is ready to put predictability and stability back into that relationship as well. Amanda Sloat, thank you so much. We appreciate your time.
Thank you.
Well, now Russia, which we were just discussing, has all but effectively banned Alexei Navalny's opposition movement this week, just days before that Biden-Putin summit. A Moscow court designated two organizations linked to the Kremlin critic as extremist groups, forcing them to shut down. They say they'll appeal that decision. Of course, Navalny is currently in prison for violating parole in an old embezzlement case that the European Court of Human Rights considers to be politically motivated. Vladimir Shurkov is the executive director of Navalny's Anti-Corruption Foundation, and he is joining me now. Vladimir, welcome to the show. First and foremost, let me get your reaction to that court ruling. I would imagine it's not surprising. Nonetheless, it's devastating for your organization.
It wasn't unexpected. It's a result of the increasing trend of oppression that has been happening over the last year, which included poisoning of Navalny, his unlawful incarceration when he returned to Russia, brutal police actions during mass protests, and now total elimination and designation of our organization, which always advocated legal actions and legal opposition, as extremist.
You just heard my conversation with Amanda and saying that this is not a reward, this summit, for Vladimir Putin from the Biden administration's perspective, but it's just laying some groundworks and the U.S. at least proposing some stability in areas where the two can cooperate.
What is your take on that? It seems that Vladimir Putin has only become more aggressive with more provocations. He said last week that any subjects regarding what happens internally within Russia are off the table. Is this summit worth happening now?
The United States and Russia are two major nuclear powers. And I think I would feel safer in the world when they talk to each other and the leaders of these countries talk to each other. So they have a broad agenda of issues to discuss, obviously security issues, anti-terrorist activities, and arms control. Some people say that this summit is a present to Vladimir Putin. I don't subscribe to this opinion.
And yet it's hard not to be alarmed by the actions of the Kremlin just in the past few months, especially since Navalny's return to Russia. They have cracked down hard on any dissidents, on any protests, on any opposition political figures, and embrace, really, Lukashenko after bringing that plane down, that passenger plane, and detaining Roman Protasevich. Vladimir Putin even answering, perhaps, we'll see, I'm not going to tell you if Russia was in a similar situation. Would he do the same thing? Are you concerned that Russia is, in fact, moving more and more under Vladimir Putin into a dictatorship, an authoritarian state?
It's true. And I think that President Biden needs to understand what's at stake. I'm sure he does. What if the atrocities that have been linked to Russia's actions, including 14,000 dead in the eastern Ukraine as a result of Russian meddling, assassinations in Russia, outside of Russia over the last few years. What if this is just a precursor for more? What if we are now in a situation similar to Hitler's Germany in the mid-30s of the last century? I think that would be the right approach. I don't have the recipes of how to implement it into a specific position, but I think this is the right approach.
Well, clearly, you note in an op-ed that you wrote recently that the approaches from the previous administration, this is now President Putin's fifth U.S. president that he is facing right now, they haven't been working or they haven't deterred Vladimir Putin. And let me quote something from a piece that you wrote in the London Times. You said, Western countries should increase the price tag of being associated with Putin's corrupt regime. Individual sanctions are a powerful but politicized instrument. However, you don't need formal sanctions to deny visas to all members of the Russian government, regional governors, members of the security apparatus, their immediate families, and business cronies. Quite simply, stop letting them in and do the same to their corrupt money, which should be expelled from the international financial system. Everything that you're hearing from the Biden administration and their approach to corruption and their approach to Russia, does that give you any hope that, these are some of the policies that we will start to see bear out?
It's an uphill struggle. It certainly would be a change from the position of previous U.S. administrations if the U.S. Will take a less tolerant stance towards corruption, in particular Russian corruption, the flows of dirty money coming out of Russia. But I'm hopeful that now is the time to change. And as Putin is getting more and more assertive, in Russia and internationally, I think this is the right course of action.
Well, there's no doubt that Putin is getting more and more assertive. One need not only look at Navalny, right, and the attempted poisoning there and other dissidents and the murders, what have you. But just recently, this week, another news organization, Bellingcat, through their investigation, found that a popular, famous poet in Russia was also followed by the same FSB group and poisoned by the same FSB agents that poisoned Navalny. And I guess the message is it could happen to anybody who speaks out against or critically against this government. What message should that send to people around the world?
Indeed, this is the latest in the string of assassinations that have been happening. The earliest, probably, that made the headlines globally was assassination of Mr. Litvinenko in London in 2007. So it's not new that Russian security services use poisoning as their instrument of policy. That's the situation that we have to deal with.
So what happens next for your organization? I know that you've stopped taking donations from supporters out of fear of their own safety. What happens to Navalny's team and to people like yourself and to those who support your cause?
The repression that that our organization is feeling now is unprecedented, but it didn't start yesterday. We have been operating under pressure throughout the existence of our team. We always regrouped, we always evolved, and that's what we plan to do now. The people in Russia are less and less content with how the country is governed, and disillusionment with Putin will translate into civil and political action. It doesn't matter whether some organization, including ours, are labeled extremist or not. It's just a natural mechanism of history.
Are these latest provocations from Vladimir Putin and the crackdowns a sign, in your opinion, of his growing strength or his growing paranoia? Is there weakness at the top of the Kremlin, in fact?
They don't seem rational. Putin's regime has amassed tremendous financial resources. They control all legislative power, the law enforcement. It seems like the nascent civil and political opposition in Russia does not present any threat. But since they respond in such a brutal and unproportional manner, I think they know something that maybe the white population doesn't. They're not very confident, and they see that their seemingly stable position is really threatened by the challenges from inside Russia, from the Western powers. So that's the situation.
Yeah, and that is something that Yevgenia Albats, who is a very prominent Russian journalist, picked up on as well this week. She described Russia now under Putin as a corporate state where all the key figures and resources and decision-making is done by the FSB, by the security agencies there. Do you get that sense as well? And can you speak more about this idea that perhaps there's something unstable at the top that the rest of the world is not yet aware of?
Broadly, that's right. The security services call the shots in terms of, you know, the court system, the law enforcement, economic activities. And Putin is, part and parcel of this system. He's a descendant from the Russian analogy of FSB. So it's true. And we don't know whether we reached the low point or we still have a long road of descent into repression and totalitarianism to go.
Dmitry Peskov, who is the spokesperson for the Kremlin, and Vladimir Putin spoke with CNN's Matthew Chance earlier today about this upcoming meeting and the relations, the poor relations, as he described them, between the two countries and two leaders. I want you to listen to what he said.
If there isn't a joint press conference, as, you know, U.S. officials are telling us that there won't be, how disappointing will that be from the Kremlin's point of view? Because I think one of the main reasons Vladimir Putin wanted to go and meet President Biden is so that he could appear on the same platform, show that he's a global statesman. That won't be an opportunity that's going to be offered to him without a joint press conference, would it?
No, this is not a, this is not a case at all. And this is not the purpose of President Putin coming to Geneva. There is no sense for him proving that he's a world statesman and so on and so forth. The main reason for him is a poor state of relationship between our two countries, and a critical level of this relationship that demands a summit between our two countries, because this is the only way to arrange an evaluation of the situation in our relationship to prevent further degradation.
So that sounds rational, right? I mean, the poor relations need to be worked on to prevent further degradation, but there's nothing rational coming out in regards to Russia and the Kremlin's latest actions. What do you make of that?
In the context of the upcoming summit, I think it's good that the leaders are talking, but I don't have any big expectation for that. I think the scope for any agreement, for any bargain, is really quite limited.
I want to play some sound from you from Dasha Navalny, who is Navalny's daughter, and she accepted the award for the 2021 Moral Courage Award for her father at the Geneva Summit for Human Rights and Democracy earlier this week. I want to play some sound for you of what she said.
I'm not going to lie, but as fun as it is to give the speech, it's sad that I'm accepting this award today. You really should be looking at my father instead, but he's in a Russian prison right now simply because of what he says, does, and believes in, and because he didn't die when the Russian government wanted him to.
How is Alexei Navalny doing, and what does the future hold for his movement, your movement, and specifically leadership, with him being behind bars almost indefinitely, one would assume, at this point?
He has come off a hunger strike, which lasted about 3 weeks. As a result of the hunger strike, his medical treatment in the prison has somewhat improved. His spirits are quite high. He, in his traditional manner, sends out messages that are both ironic and encouraging for his supporters, and show that he hasn't lost his nerve. In terms of future, again, the history, I think, has only one way to go. Russia belongs to the European civilization, more generally to Western civilization in terms of history, culture, and it's only a matter of time when change will come in Russia and it will resume its way on the path to being a normal civilized country.
Vladimir, I have to say it is reassuring to hear those words from you, those uplifting words. And as you mentioned, Alexei Navalny, his Instagram posts, all of his messages continue to reiterate that same assurances and reminding his supporters to be strong and be brave and with a little bit of humor as well. Very unique to him. Thank you so much for joining us. We appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
Now, they are some of the wealthiest and most powerful men in the world. Jeff Bezos, Michael Bloomberg, Warren Buffett, Elon Musk, just to name a few. Well, Pulitzer Prize-winning ProPublica reporter Jesse Eisinger has delved into their never-before-seen tax returns. They reveal that when it comes to income tax, these business moguls only pay a tiny fraction of the hundreds of millions, if not billions of dollars, their fortunes grow every year. Here's our Hari Srinivasan speaking to him about how they manage to legally work the system.
Bianca, thanks. Jesse Eisinger from ProPublica, thanks for joining us. You know, there's that old cliche, there's only two things certain in life, death and taxes. But your report, what it finds is if you're really, really wealthy, taxes, not so much. How did you find this information?
We have obtained, ProPublica has obtained over 15 years of information, tax returns, and information from the schedules that go into the returns about things like stock trading and gambling winnings and partnerships for thousands of the wealthiest individuals. This is really just the 1% of the 1%. We're not commenting on how we obtain the material. We're trying to protect the source or sources. We are explaining that we verified it extensively and are being very careful stewards of the information.
So when you look at this, this is the first of your series of reports, but you see a glaring pattern here. Most of us anecdotally think, well, the rich probably have better accountants, etc. But what you're showing is a structural flaw in the system.
Yeah, exactly. This isn't about evading taxes exotically and illicitly. This is about routine and perfectly legal tax avoidance strategies. And you don't need a fancy accountant for this. What we show is the system and the system's essential unfairness, which is that average Americans are stuck in the tax system. We have no choice in the matter. We work to live. We have to work. We get salaries and taxes get extracted from our paychecks. The wealthy, the ultra wealthy especially, are completely outside of this system entirely. They don't have to take income. When they do take income, it's in the time of the place of their choosing. And therefore, they can really lower their tax burden or not have a tax burden. And what we show is that some of these guys, Jeff Bezos, Elon Musk, Michael Bloomberg, Carl Icahn, they actually paid zero in federal taxes in recent years.
So Jeff Bezos, let's take a look at him for a second. You've got a little card on your website. It says between 2014 and 2018, his wealth grew $99 billion, but his total reported income, which is different than your wealth growing, is $4.22 billion. That's about 4% of his wealth. And on that, he paid $973 million in taxes. Now, people are going to look at that number and say, $973 million, that's a lot of tax.
Right.
What's the point that you're making?
Right. So it does. It's an enormous number. We can't even contemplate that number, much less the $100 billion that his wealth grew. But the essential number here is that it is a fraction, a tiny fraction of his wealth growth. And what we're arguing in the piece, essentially, is that wealth growth is the true measure of his income, the equivalent of average people's income. And so when you compare that figure of almost $1 billion to $100 billion, it's about 1%. It's slightly less than 1%. The average person's income, when that's taken out for taxes, it's about 14%. So the average person making $60,000 or $70,000 a year is paying $14 in taxes each year. And Jeff Bezos, on the relevant figure, is paying less than $1. And why do we think this is the relevant figure? Well, everything emanates from wealth growth for the ultra wealthy. They, all of their power, all of their influence, all of the way that they can purchase lavish lifestyles. Jeff Bezos is building a yacht for his yacht, a yacht that will take the helicopters for his yacht that is worth or costing about $500 million. He bought, of course, the Washington Post for half that, $200 million. It affords him political influence. All of that comes from his wealth. What's incredible to us, what was astounding to us, is that all of this wealth growth is really outside of the tax system almost entirely, and just not taxed because of what we choose to tax in this country and what we choose not to tax.
In those years that you had Jeff Bezos' filings, he took a child tax credit?
Yes. In 2011, he reported a very modest amount of income and then was able to wipe that out with deductions. And because of that, he had so little income that he was able to claim the child tax credit for then two children, $4,000. So he actually had negative income. He had a credit from the U.S. government. He was then in 2011 clearly one of the richest people in the world. But, you know, every dollar counts.
So where do the ultra wealthy get their money to spend, right? I mean, you and I have checking accounts and saving accounts and maybe a retirement account if we're lucky, right? But we also have an income that comes in every couple of weeks and we say, okay, well, this is my budget. Well, if you're super wealthy and you aren't getting an income, because a lot of tech billionaires will actually just work for a dollar a year. So where are they getting that money?
Yeah, that's a very good point. They don't take salaries often. Jeff Bezos has a middle-class salary of about $80,000. And then we've seen kind of ostentatious displays of $1 salaries from the likes of Mark Zuckerberg or the Google boys, Sergey Brin and Larry Page. So your question is, where do they get the money? And the answer is not for everybody, but often they're borrowing. They're borrowing against their stock. They put up their stock as collateral in their borrowing. So somebody like Elon Musk discloses in his security filings that he's pledged tens of millions of dollars of stock and borrowed against it again for tens of billions of dollars. And this is how they fund their lifestyles often. We don't have any evidence that Bezos is borrowing. He may be, he may not be. Not everybody has the same hymn book here. But what's happening is they borrow, and when they borrow, of course, they're not taking income, they're not selling their stocks, they're not paying capital gains on that stock that they're not selling. They're keeping control of their companies. And when you borrow, you don't pay any income tax on the borrowing. So it's a win-win-win in all of the ways that you can imagine it.
So if I'm a billionaire, I just decide to go to a bank and say, you know, I'm good for it. I got multiple billions of dollars in stock. Why don't you just loan me a couple of hundred million at 2 or 3%, because that's cheaper for me to pay you back than it is to pay Uncle Sam if I actually cash that out and look like I made 200 million?
Hari, you are thinking small, couple hundred million. Carl Icahn has essentially something like a mortgage for $1.2 billion that was in his tax filings. And as I say, Elon Musk has tens of billions. And Larry Ellison of Oracle disclosed in securities filings a few years ago that he had a $10 billion credit line. So start thinking a little bigger. But yes, banks are happy to offer these guys. They are good for it. And they charge relatively low interest rates. And you just roll over that debt all the way, sometimes all the way until you die. And we'll get to that in a second. But the whole strategy is encapsulated by the phrase buy, borrow, die. That's an Ed McCaffrey phrase. He's a tax professor from USC. And what it is you buy your asset or you build your asset. Obviously, Bezos and Musk built their companies. You inherit. The Waltons and the Mars family have inherited great fortunes. Then you borrow against it, and then you can evade or escape or avoid, not really evade because it's all legal. You can avoid taxation at death. You can avoid the estate tax through different kinds of maneuvers. And then essentially your great fortune has been almost untaxed throughout your life and into death.
So here's the thing. Some of the people that you profiled, you took you kind of made baseball cards out of Warren Buffett and Michael Bloomberg. These are people who Michael Bloomberg on the campaign trail campaigned for changes in taxes. Warren Buffett famously has come out and said, this doesn't make any sense that I pay less tax as a percent than my secretary does, right? So what did you find about what they're doing legally?
Yeah, well, that's a very interesting question, Buffett, because what we found is that no one has avoided more tax for as long as Warren Buffett. And he's regarded as a kind of grandfatherly figure. He's beloved. And of course, he has come out to his credit and said that the wealthy don't pay enough in taxes. But when he's talking about that, he's talking about it in this extraordinarily narrow way, where he says taxes on income are too low for the wealthy, and capital gains taxes are too low. And he says, I have capital gains sometimes, and I pay a very low rate compared to my secretary. And he's right. He pays a relatively low rate. But what's really extraordinary about Warren Buffett is he takes so little income. He takes tiny fractions of his enormous wealth. Now he's worth over $100 billion. And he takes tiny, tiny fractions of that in income and then pays a very small percentage of that. So when we measured how much he paid in taxes compared to his wealth growth, he actually pays 10 cents for every $100 that his wealth grows. 10 cents for every $100 his wealth grows. The wealthy, the top 25, pay $3.40 for every $100 their wealth grew, the richest 25 people in America. Meanwhile, as I say, the average American, when you talk about income tax, which is really the the way they are taxed, it's $14 for every $100 they bring in.
In your analysis, the 25 richest Americans showed by the end of 2018, those 25 were worth $1.1 trillion. It would take 14.3 million ordinary American wage earners put together to equal that same amount of wealth. The personal federal tax bill for the top 25 in 2018, just those 25 people, was $1.9 billion. The bill for those wage earners, the 14 million wage earners put together, was $143 billion. So those average wage earners are not only paying a disproportionate share of their own taxes, they're paying more in raw numbers as well to the federal government.
Absolutely. And that astonishing figure was done by my colleague, Jeff Ernsthausen, who has worked with me on the story. And we really wanted to highlight this basic imbalance, this stunning imbalance where the ultra wealthy can develop enormous sums from which, as I said, all of their power and influence emanates and all their means emanates. And it's really outside of the tax system. Those 14 plus million people are inside the tax system and they're paying their fair share. And the consequences of this are that we have struggled in this country to adequately fund the federal government. Periodically, people are convulsed in fear that Social Security and Medicaid, or excuse me, Medicare will go broke. Roads and bridges are crumbling. We need to provide for the national defense. And if the federal government is constrained because the people with the most wealth are not paying their fair share, then we wanted to highlight that system and really shine a light on it.
So, you know, there are a lot of wealthy people, Warren Buffett included, that say, I don't want to give it to Uncle Sam. You know, I'm going to give 99.5% of my wealth away in charitable donations and philanthropic giving. I just think that I'm a better steward of my hard-earned money than the government is. What's wrong with that idea?
Yes, he said exactly that. Said, I don't want to go have my money being paid, have the debt paid down to China when I can allocate it to something that will do more for society. And one answer is, boy, I would like to allocate my tax dollars the way I want to. I bet all the viewers would too. I bet most people have pretty strong opinions about how the doofuses in Washington are spending my hard-earned money and that I could do it better than they do. And that's why we have elections and why we have a democratic society. It's a shared responsibility to elect leaders who then allocate our tax dollars in the way the majority theoretically wants. The other thing is that philanthropy doesn't solve collective problems very well. It doesn't build roads and bridges. It doesn't do mundane things. Philanthropy often for the ultra wealthy are ways that they can put forward their own policy choices, try to dominate the conversation, have disproportionate influence. Sometimes they fund political campaigns. Sometimes they ride their hobbies and obsessions. It's not really the way we want to run society. It's a distortion of society to have billionaires with disproportionate influence and also be subsidized by taxpayers.
You know, one of the pushbacks is going to be corporate taxes, right? Warren Buffett says Berkshire Hathaway pays a ton of corporate taxes. What's your problem here? If I have my money in that, my corporation is actually paying those taxes, I'm not trying to steal from the government.
Yeah, that's a valid point, and there's a lot of debate amongst economists about this. What I would say, two things. One is we're in a golden age of corporate tax avoidance. So companies like Amazon and Apple and Facebook and Microsoft have gone to great lengths to move operations overseas to avoid American tax. And sometimes these giant corporations also pay zero in tax. So You know, Amazon is a tax avoider, both at the corporate level and then at the ownership level. The second thing is that corporate taxes don't solely fall on the owners of the corporations. This is a matter of debate, but consumers pay corporate taxes, workers pay corporate taxes. At least some economists think so. So this is sort of dispersed. That's not a direct tax on the owners of the company, not a direct tax on Bezos or Musk. So one way to solve this would be to have more direct taxes on the owners of the companies.
Jesse Eisinger, senior reporter and editor at ProPublica, thanks so much.
Thank you for having me.
An extraordinary insight into the taxes of the rich and powerful there. And finally, remember working in the office? I've only been doing it a few weeks now, and I'm still getting used to it. Well, that everyday reality was turned upside down by the pandemic, sending many across the world to adapt to the working from home policy. Well, as the outbreak eases in many parts of the world, companies are trying to figure out what a return to the workplace will actually look like and how much remote working will be part of the new normal. Can a hybrid system be adapted, or will remote work be offered as a permanent option for some post-pandemic? Gene Twenge is a professor of psychology at San Diego State University and the author of iGen. She joins me now. Gene, thank you so much for joining us. We should note off the bat that many people were fortunate to be able to have the option to work from home. We know that many people had to go, frontline workers had to be at work in those early days especially, and were exposed to the virus and the dangers of that. So let's start there. But for those people who were able to work from home and have the option, what are some of the biggest concerns that you're hearing about returning to the office?
You know, a lot of people really got used to working from home and all of its advantages. So especially if you have kids, you can be there when the kids come home from school. You can have a little bit more of a flexible schedule. There's benefits in you don't have to eat out all of the time. You lose the commute. So there's this big portion of your day that you get back that you used to spend driving or sitting in traffic. So there's all these upsides to working at home. And with people going back to the office, they're missing some of those advantages. And it's such a trade-off, because there's also huge advantages to being in the office and seeing each other and having collaboration and meetings and so on. But it's a very tough adjustment for a lot of people who got used to all the huge advantages of working from home.
It's interesting, because I didn't hear you mention just the health concerns and the risks there. How high are those concerns, and how heavily weighted are those in terms of, even though you may have been vaccinated, perhaps you can still get sick, perhaps there are those in your office who haven't been vaccinated. Is that as much of a concern, or is it just more change of scenery and change of habits?
Well, you know, we're in an interesting place right now with the pandemic, because vaccines are available to everyone ages 12 and over, with the exception, of course, of people who may have medical conditions that prevent that. So we've got those opportunities out there. A lot of people have been vaccinated, and the vaccines are extremely effective. So in theory, this should mean that we can really start opening back up. But as you're correct, it's true. You can still have outbreaks, especially if you have a large proportion of people who are unvaccinated. But I think people are ready. I think most people maybe still, you know, have to get comfortable with, you know, saying, I think it's going to be a while before we have large indoor concerts, for example. Right. But going to work, people are starting to get adjusted to that. We have things opening up a lot more. I don't think that's as top of mind for most people as the adjustment to, hey, you know, working from home was great in a lot of ways, and we got to get back into the rhythm of the office.
Well, let's look at some of the statistics there, because 39% of adults say that they would consider quitting if their employers weren't flexible about remote working. 97% of companies said they are indeed planning for some kind of hybrid work. I just know anecdotally I've been seeing, and even with CNN, they've been very flexible and gracious in terms of factoring in people's own personal concerns and comfort with coming back. Do you see a point where that can change, or is this sort of here to stay for at least the next year or so?
Well, it's going to be interesting to watch, because there's several polls showing that especially younger generations, so millennials, but especially Gen Z, or as I call them, iGen, those born 1995 and later, so 26 and under, they have gotten very used to this. So they're actually less likely to have kids at home, but they really see a lot of the efficiency and the freedom in working from home. So some of more recently students, you know, they're much more used to this idea of making their time their own, say if they've been in college. They're very tech savvy, used to working remote, you know, in terms of, you know, they're used to video calls, used to communication that's electronic. So I think there's also resistance from, you know, a lot of Gen Xers and boomers, from family situations, health concerns, other things. But I think we're going to see a lot of pushback, maybe particularly from younger people who really want to stay working from home. And a lot of them in polls, many of them say, yeah, if I don't continue to have that option of working from home, I will quit. So it's good that companies are being responsive to that. It's going to be a very careful balance going forward, because I think we really are reimagining work in this country now after this experience, not just in terms of working from home, but in terms of having meaning at work and making sure that that job's really the one that you want to have. So I think there are a lot of industries, a lot of offices are going to be roiled by these changes, with so many people insisting on things being different.
It's interesting that you focus on the educational, the age divide, right, and the generational divide. You've written literally books on younger generations. And if you think about what the younger generations, particularly millennials, have gone through just professionally, there's been the financial crisis. Obviously, student debt is at its highest levels that it's been in decades. And now they have a pandemic that they're entering. It's important to factor in that most of their work life has not been the 9 to 5 hours inside of an office the way other generations have been used to.
Yeah, I mean, working from home is not new to the pandemic. You know, it had been growing for a good 20 years before the pandemic hit. And it is younger generations who see that as much more of an option. And I, you know, I think there's another piece of this puzzle that has not been considered, that there's a very common perception that millennials in particular are way behind in terms of their wages, their income compared to other generations. You know, maybe they wouldn't quit because, you know, they haven't done too well. Actually, if you look at the statistics, millennials have done pretty well. Their household income is very competitive, in some cases even higher than Gen Xers and boomers at the same age. So I think if you're, you know, in a position where you have a lot of young workers, you might think, oh, They're not going to quit. They're still paying off student loans. Well, maybe, but a lot of them have done very well. In fact, it's one of the reasons, for example, for the huge run-up in the housing market. That's millennials who are out there buying those houses. And they may have put that off for a few more years, but they're doing it now, and it's causing a total crisis in the housing market because they do have money to spend.
Yeah, that's important to note, because over the past few decades, they have been studying some of these higher paying professions, right? And so their jobs pay higher, perhaps if they go on to be entrepreneurs themselves, or just from a corporate standpoint, they're in these high tech, they're in healthcare, they're in higher payer jobs. For parents, you know, this is something that's a difficult discussion to have with children. It's been a privilege for those that have been able to work from home and not those frontline and first responders who had to go from day one. But for those that were able to spend some time and work from home and see their kids on a daily basis, this is also going to be a bit challenging. The separation, the going back to, you know, pre-pandemic is psychologically going to be difficult for both children and parents. How do you see that playing out?
Yeah, this experience, you know, the last year and a half, it's been such a roller coaster. And there have been some silver linings during the pandemic. So last year, I teamed up with the Institute for Family Studies, and we did a survey of parents and of teens, one in the spring, one in the fall, to see how people were feeling, how families were doing during this time. And one notable finding, 2/3 of the teens in our survey said that they felt they were closer to their families than they were before the pandemic. And I think a lot of parents would say the same, especially when they got to work from home and their kids were home. Now, you know, we're on a cakewalk. We were all trying to have, you know, 5 different Zoom meetings at the same time, trying to help kids with schoolwork and work. You know, it has been crazy. But the one upside for some people has been that family time. And everybody's heading back to the office 40, 50 hours a week, getting back to that commute. It is going to be an adjustment for everybody. And kids are also going to have to get used to mom and dad not being around as much. But they'll just, you know, kids are resilient. I think in many cases, it's harder for the parents.
Oh, yeah. Kids are extremely resilient. I was worried that they wouldn't be able to wear masks all day at school. And that hasn't been the problem. The problem hasn't been kids wearing masks. It's the adults that couldn't keep a mask on all day. Jean Twenge, thank you so much for this. This is an important conversation that millions of households are now having to talk about as they are going back into the office. We appreciate it. Have a good weekend.
Thank you. You too.
Well, that is it for now. You can always catch us online and on our podcast across social media. Thank you so much for watching, and goodbye from New York.
Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number 1 in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
You can now watch CNN's 5 Things on Max. Each weekday, Kate Baldwin breaks down the 5 essential news stories in 5 minutes or less. She'll get you up to speed and on with your day. CNN's 5 Things with Kate Baldwin, streaming weekdays exclusively on Max.